talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Political violence in the U.S. has reached epic proportions due to the polarization in the country. One example, the U.S. President Joe Biden has accused his predecessor Donald Trump and his supporters of undermining democracy ahead of next week's midterm elections. Some Republican candidates have said that they may refuse to accept the outcome should they lose. This comes on top of the most recent act of violence against the husband of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who was attacked with a hammer. How have U.S. politics reached a point where politicians are threatening each other and Americans are acting out violently?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and commentator Don DeBart joins us from Austin, New York. Also joining us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar, also joining us from New York. Okay, welcome to you both. So we are continuing this U.S. political violence theme in another episode of our program, and we deemed it to be that important, and I mentioned that in the last time we had that to both of you, because there were some revelations that were unprecedented in a sense, which is not associated in the mainstream outside of the U.S., perhaps, in terms of the depth of what this really means. So we had this attack, Daniel Lazar, first start with you, where you had Nancy Pelosi's husband, and I remember last time I made a mistake saying axe. Anyways, he was hit with a hammer. But the person who was looking for her, for the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of which he said that he would injure her. Now the question comes about: is this just a lone incident of somebody, an American, acting out in this form and manner, which is obviously very violent?
Well, it's hard to say, but it's definitely, there's no question that tempers are rising, that tensions are increasing. There is a huge degree of polarization. People are very angry, and there's a great deal of talk of violence in the air. I mean, after all, on January 6, 2021, we had a mob invade Washington. Four or five people were killed. The mob, members of the mob chanted, where is Nancy? Where is Nancy? Nancy Pelosi is a polarizing figure. And they engage in a great deal of destruction and would likely have killed Nancy Pelosi if they'd gotten their hands on her. Probably is the same thing true for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others. So, there's a real danger of violence because the machinery of government is breaking down, and as it breaks down, anger and frustration are increasing on all sides.
Don DeBart, isn't it a far cry, though, to have people, average Americans, in a matter of speaking, act out against politicians in a way? Well, I guess they mentioned the January 6th incident that happened there on Capitol Hill. For them to come out and want to kill their lawmakers, the U.S. politicians, how should one view that?
Well, let's look at it through the prism of the editorial pages of the New York Times in July 2018, where after Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin to try to calm relations between the two countries, accused Trump of treason, and there were calls for him to be prosecuted for that, which, by the way, carries the death penalty. Let's start there. This is something that's been tracked. At Pew Research, for example, did a study in 2014 looking at the period from 1994 to 2014 and shows the entrenchment of this polarization where large chunks of people on the left and right, quote unquote, these terms are really kind of meaningless right now, but the liberal and conservative are the terms they used in their study of the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, how the number of Democrats that identified as liberal and Republicans that identified as conservatives had grown and hardened. The phenomenon really didn't begin in 1994. It began much earlier, of course. I remember the presidential election in 1980, for example. At the time, however, Democrats that identified as liberals were, among other things, anti-war, for example. One of the big fears of Reagan being elected in 1980 was that he would start a war with the Soviet Union. Here we are with someone who everyone calls in the political economy here a liberal. Joe Biden is actually at war with Russia. You know, there's a lot of stuff to really sort of plod through here. There's just one last point because I want clarity on this from the last conversation that we had. You know, Dan correctly referred to the fact that there is this other process where if there's a block, basically if the vote from each state at the joint session in January 6th is rejected, then the electors are chosen by a different mechanism than, you know, than, in other words, not voted on by the House members, but rather by people that are selected to do that job. As a matter of fact, you would never get there because you would first have votes in each of the two chambers on the challenges, and in each of those cases, those votes would be conducted in houses of Congress that had Democratic majorities on January 6, 2021. So the idea that somehow that insurrection was tied to a strategy for a coup d'etat, really, it just falls.
Okay, very well. Let's look at how long this has been going on, this term political violence, and, of course, the way that it has now really brought into the fore, Daniel Lazar. I mean, I went back as far as Abe Lincoln and the assassination that happened there, of which the person that did it said, I did what I thought was best. And then you had some periodicals that wrote, that the Almighty God has ordered this event. And I mentioned that in terms of the periodicals, and I want to kind of compare that to or make a note of what our guest there, Dan DeBar, said, that the New York Times, as a media or a print media, is also lending a hand in the way that things become polarized by drawing that type of analysis. So are we looking as that as being a something that has happened from way before and is just continued throughout the decades in the U.S.?
Well, not quite. I mean, first of all, the Lincoln was assassinated at the very end of a civil war which claimed 600,000 lives in a country at the time had that population about 24 million. So, you know, it was a bloody, bloody war, a huge war, and it culminated with the assassination of the leader of the Union forces. But after that, you know, things died down. There was little of that sort of thing in Washington. But beginning in the 1960s, 1968, we saw a series of assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. We saw the assassination of JFK in 63. But there's no doubt that passions have been heating up since the 1990s in a new way. The machinery of government is breaking down. We have had gridlock, an absolute deadlock in Congress for 30 years or so. Nothing can get done, and the less that gets done, the more frustrations rise on either side, and the more poisonous the atmosphere becomes.
Give us some examples.
Well, you know, Newt Gingrich shut down the government on two different occasions. They impeached Bill Clinton for the crime of having a sexual, you know, engagement with one of with a White House aide. You know, each of these things, you know, sort of raised tempers to new levels, and there was no way of resolving these things because the angrier Republicans got, then the angrier Democrats got, and the more Congress stopped working.
Uh-huh.
The American government is based on this bizarre 18th century system of checks and balances. Basically, you have to have three or even four major institutions agree before anything can get done. That's the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. And if one of each of those bodies has veto power. So what you found starting in the mid-90s was that that Congress and the presidency were vetoing one another constantly, and nothing happened. Nothing got done. And the more of a stalemate you had, the angrier people got. And then the angrier they got, the more they dug their heels in.
I see.
You know, so the process is kind of self-fueling. And so tempers are now shooting upwards. We'll see what happens on the election on Tuesday. But I think that there's no doubt that the basic governmental functions in the U.S. are hanging in the balance. And American democracy, such as it is facing a major crisis. I mean, I rarely agree with Joe Biden about anything. But in this case, he is correct. The country is facing a major structural crisis.
Well, Don DeBar, since our guest mentioned the midterms, looking at what the latest is on Joe Biden, who has obviously made a point to call upon the midterms and says, basically saying that, you know, this is something that is chipping away at the U.S. democracy this shouldn't be happening. Why is the midterms going to be a reflection of this in the sense that Joe Biden is painting that picture? Do you agree with him?
He has to paint that picture. First of all, look at Biden's own numbers. His numbers are the lowest for any sitting president since the day before Nixon resigned. That's a fact. And it's been that way for a good while now. He needs some sort of a distraction, or they're going to lose both houses, and he's may well be impeached. That's a fact also. Let's start with JFK, who was assassinated in November 1963, Malcolm X, who was assassinated in February 1965, Martin Luther King in April of 1968, Robert Kennedy in June of 1968. In each case, security forces inside the United States have at least been implicated if they have not been held responsible. Okay, if we look further, if you want to talk about political violence, hold the picture of Muammar Gaddafi after he was run with a spear or a gun with a knife on it, whatever you call it, bayonet. And the words, we came, they saw, he died. That's out of Hillary Clinton's mouth. I don't know how anyone can be sanctimonious about political violence when that's their team.
Mm-hmm.
This is something, again, and you asked, I missed it, because when we talk at the same time over these, media, I can't hear when you, et cetera. You asked when H.R.A.P. Brown said that violence is as American as apple pie. And it was in 1967. So that's in the midst of the assassinations that I just ran. You know, we've seen political assassinations all the way up to an attempt today where they tried to kill Imran Khan. I'm guessing if you find a dirty hand there, if the assassin, the attempted assassin, actually the assassin, because he did kill some other people, if they actually get him to trial, you may find out that the U.S. had a hand in that. Or look at Dugina, Dugin's daughter.
Uh-huh.
That assassination, certainly the U.S. or the U.K., the Ukrainians, et cetera, had a hand in that. This is political violence. This is real political violence. The attempts on Castro's life, over the course of his time in office in Cuba, the attempts on Nicolas Maduro's life. I mean, this is U.S. policy.
Sure.
Why suddenly is a guy with horns a major threat to the U.S. democracy? I don't understand it. It's so absurd.
It is. Now we're talking about the international arena and how the U.S. acts regarding that. But we're focusing on the U.S. here, so we have to go with that line for this program.
Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were domestic, and so were the two Kennedys.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay. To expand further on what Joe Biden said there, Daniel Lazar, which is what we're getting at here in some sense, or what I'm trying to get at from you, is the fact that political violence, according to the U.S. Biden, U.S. President Joe Biden has said that it is undermining democracy. And he says, make no mistake, democracy is on the ballot for all of us. Do you agree with him?
I do, actually, yes. I mean, first of all, let me say that Don is correct. I mean, the U.S. has pursued violent policies abroad, for decades. And the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is just merely one example of U.S. policy. But the U.S. domestically has been kind of sort of a democracy all this period, and that matters too. People can speak their mind. I can write whatever I want to without worrying about police breaking down my door. And elections have been in general kind of decided in a fair and democratic manner. But that is breaking down dramatically. Joe Biden's speech was it was classic Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't admit that the American system as it presently exists is falling apart before our very eyes. So it isn't that the Republicans are doing this single-handedly. The Republicans are merely acting in response to what is plainly a systemic collapse. American political institutions are 235 years old. They have never been subject to a fundamental overhaul. The system is so old, so out of date, so unresponsive to the needs of modern society, it's not funny. And yet the system is so frozen that any kind of reform is impossible. So we have an electoral college, a Senate which is unrepresentative. We have a Senate which is grossly unrepresentative. In the Senate, a majority of the population lives in just 10 states that are outvoted by the minority in the other 40. In the House, which is supposedly more democratic, Republicans have enjoyed a 12 or 14% advantage since 2010. And now in the Supreme Court, Republicans have an unbreakable 6-3 majority. And that majority will persist for probably another decade. They have got a free hand to do whatever they want with American society, and the Democratic majority is powerless. So Americans live under a minority dictatorship, and that dictatorship is growing.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Americans living under a dictatorship. Well, Don DeBar, based on what Daniel Lazar there said, are we looking at a solution which is far-fetched, but then again, is something that could be put out there, and that is a reform, which I think Daniel Lazar said a reform is not even possible at this point, that you need an overhaul, I guess, of the whole system, so to speak. I mean, is that something but is that feasible? Is that realistic to look at it that way? And is that a cause of what we call one of the outcomes being a political violence that has been part of U.S. politics and the mainstream average Joe on the streets there in the U.S.?
First, I'll agree in part with what Daniel just said about there being a systemic problem. Some evidence of that. I did a Google search for illegitimate president and qualified it before 12/31/2019. Hillary Clinton, here's a headline from the Independent in the UK. Hillary Clinton says Trump knows he's an illegitimate president. There's quotes and such. Former President Jimmy Carter says Trump is an illegitimate president. That's from Vox and NBC News. He lost the election, then he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf. This has been going on certainly since the 2016 election in depth. And let's not forget that there were mobs. If what was outside the Capitol was a mob on January 6th, 2021, there were mobs on Inauguration Day in 2017 and lots of other occasions like during the Supreme Court appointments of Kavanaugh and others. This is something that I agree that there's a breakdown here. What I don't agree is that the solution is going to be somehow to redo the Constitution because it's 235 years old, because the first question that arises is who exactly is going to be in charge of that process. Because the real problem is that there is power that is much greater than the construct of that 235-year-old constitution that sits on top of an empire around the world. And that is who would be handling the rewrite of the U.S. Constitution. And my guess is that the first target would be the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, we have some serious structural problems. The structural problems that we have is we have the largest military in the world. That's a bipartisan effort. You know, I don't know how you vote for democracy in the face of that when each party does nothing but increase the military budget and the reach of the military across the planet every time they're voted in. That's the problem that we have. I think our structural problems are a lot deeper than the old documents.
Sure. Well, the problems are so deep that there are not many, but there are some publications out there, Daniel Lazar, that there's been talk about dividing the U.S. along the red and blue states. I mean, there's even been talks of that. So is that how deep this problem of political violence is, that it needs to go in that direction? I mean, we've heard about that. There's even been states that have said that they want to separate themselves from the U.S. But then overall, what about that approach? What's your thoughts on that?
I don't think that approach will work. I mean, that's a neo.
Not that it works, but what do you think about the fact that it went there?
I think it shows how polarized things are, and how the country is splitting up geographically as well as ideologically. There's no doubt about that. But listen, you have a 235-year-old system, and the idea that you can't touch this, that it is not subject to a democratic overhaul, is ridiculous. I mean, how much longer can people put up with this? Another 200 years? I mean, you know, would you want the same government in Iran that you had in the late 18th century? Does Russia want to go back to the age of Catherine the Great? Does France want to go back to the age of Louis the 16th? This is, you know, the American government actually dates from the final years of Louis the 16th. And it has not changed fundamentally since.
Uh-huh.
This is a complete absurdity that people don't realize, even Americans don't realize, how profoundly conservative and backward their political system is.
Okay.
It's remarkable.
Well, the political violence has reached proportions that could be called epic, Don DeBar, if you agree or not. But there's also been this coverage that some are saying may result in a civil war, that the political violence, because of a surge, a civil war is not so out of reach, and that it's exaggerated. Is it?
I think a civil war is being stoked, certainly. I don't think that the contradictions that exist materially in the United States actually lead to one. There are some astroturfed ideological differences that induce that kind of polarization. I mean, this has been the tradecraft of the CIA around the world. And look at all of Latin America. Even look at the attempted color revolution in Iran recently and the things that happen around the world like this. They go in, they have a media that divides the population, and they fight over things that are insignificant. But a major policy is made behind the scenes. And, the fact that I don't understand what the process would be,
sure,
the democratic process would be in the United States to amend the Constitution, because I don't understand what democratic institution would conduct it.
Very well. I'm sorry, I got to jump in because we're just out of time here. Don DeBar, I do apologize. I'm sorry, we're just out of time. Activist and commentator Don DeBar, their journalist and author. Daniel Lazar, thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank
and
you.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikovi Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم واجعلني من ورثة جنة النعيم.
And place me among the inheritors of the garden of pleasure.
واغفر لأبي إنه كان من الضالين.
And forgive my father. Indeed, he has been of those astray.
Dear listeners, previously, as you were with us, we were discussing the 85th verse of this chapter. وَجْعَلْنِي مِنْ وَرَثَةِ جَنَّةِ النَّعِيمِ. And 86th one, وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ. And make me of the heirs of the Garden of Bliss, and forgive my father, verily he is of those astray. As you may remember, from 83rd verse, the supplications of Abraham and his beseeching before the presence of Allah began. So as we said, why he changes the addressee from those people and turns to Almighty Allah, the Lord of the worlds, it might be that after inviting those misguided people onto Allah, and after Prophet Abraham stated the manifestations of the lordship of Allah in the world of existence, he somehow understands that they are truly misguided. He becomes completely hopeless of them. So he turns to the presence of Allah and asks him whatever he wants. So this way, he can show these idolaters that whatever they are desiring for in this life and whatever they can possibly think of in the other world, they ought to ask him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Prophet Abraham started, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ وَاجْعَلْ لِي لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ وَاجْعَلْنِي مِنْ وَرَثَةِ جَنَّةِ النَّعِيمِ. And the last one, وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ. In this fifth supplication, Prophet Abraham prays for his misguided uncle. And according to his saying that he had promised Adhar to ask Allah forgiveness for him, in this holy verse he says, وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي, and forgive my father, إِنَّهُ, verily, he is of those astray. كَانَ مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ. Prophet Abraham had formerly promised his uncle to pray for him, as the text of the Holy Quran explicitly says. Prophet Abraham was still hopeful of returning him to Allah, of making him from the believers, of turning him, of changing him. And that's why he was never hopeless of him. So he had promised him to ask Almighty Allah for his forgiveness. As the Holy Quran says, سَأَسْتَغْفِرُ لَكَ رَبِّي. And elsewhere, the Holy Quran says, and Abraham seeking forgiveness for his father was only because of promise he had made to him. So Abraham's aim was that by this way, he could penetrate into his uncle's heart and drag him faith. وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي, Prophet Abraham says to Allah, and forgive my father.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In
this
series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, in this part, in this fifth supplication mentioned in these couple of verses, Prophet Abraham prays for his uncle, his misguided uncle. وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ. And it is interesting that, and we can somehow implicitly learn from this part of the Holy Quran and from the story of Abraham from in this chapter, that we must be really careful about our relatives, our close kinship. We must try to invite them to monotheism. We must try to change their beliefs, to return them from being misguided. And the practical meaning of being careful for your close ones is that you enjoin good, forbid the evil, and then you start praying for them. وَغْفِرْ لِأَبِي إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ. At first, Prophet Abraham invited him. He forbid the evil that they were worshipping the idols. And then he started praying for him. So he gave him such a promise, he fulfilled his promise to pray for Allah, and as Ibn Abbas in a narration says, Abraham sought forgiveness repeatedly for his uncle Adar, but when Adar died in his disbelief and his enmity against the religion of truth was proven, Abraham ceased seeking forgiveness for him. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B-4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at the range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes, and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Shortly before their midterm legislative elections, a stunning new poll shows that 9 out of 10 Americans are afraid of politically motivated violence. The blame is apportioned in almost equal thirds. Democrats blame Republicans, Republican respondents hold Democrats responsible, and another third says both parties are equally responsible.
Neither party is actually putting forward any platform for actual unity across race, gender, class, etc., religion, and you know it's a necessary outcome of just the decades of politicization, and really the political moment that we're in right now, where you know there's a fascist movement in this country.
There have been 10 times the number of threats against members of Congress than there were just 5 years ago. The arrival of the corrosive Donald Trump and the seemingly equally corrosive repression of his supporters has revealed a national political culture plagued by self-righteousness, anger, and violence. An extensive recent survey found that nearly a third of Americans believe that political violence is usually or always justified.
So I think the violence already is happening. I think it's the question of, you know, as we get closer to 2024, that violence is going to get turned up a dial. So I think it's really, it's sad, unfortunate, it's terrible, but I think it's a consequence of, you know, what the ruling class has actually, you know, fomented.
The poll was taken shortly after the in-home attack on the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Many are shocked that the nation's vast and armed-to-the-teeth security services couldn't adequately protect the home of the nation's number three post. The incident continues to be the subject of salacious allegations, which have been exacerbated by the Pelosi's refusal to release their home security footage, as well as the refusal of local police to release their own body camera footage. The suppression of news reports on the incident has further inflamed public opinion. Polls repeatedly show that Nancy Pelosi has the lowest approval ratings of any prominent member of Congress. Pelosi's have been recently accused of insider trading, and the extremely wealthy family is often criticized for flaunting their affluence. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pereza, London.
An Islamophobia scandal now threatens a British student union following anger over the sacking of its female Muslim president amid allegations of anti-Semitism. Shaima Dalali was elected president of the National Union of Students in March. Dalali was initially hailed for being the first ever black Muslim female to take up the post. However, she was suspended from the role in July amid an investigation into anti-Israel comments she made up to 10 years prior to her election, including a 2012 tweet in which Ms. Dalali wrote, "Khayber, Khayber, O Jews, Mohammed's army will return to Gaza," a tweet she has since apologized for. An NUS statement on the decision said,
"Following the independent King's College-led investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism, specifically into the then president-elect under the NUS Code of Conduct, an independent panel has found that significant breaches of NUS's policies have taken place. As per this finding, we have terminated the president's contract."
Dalali expressed further fury at the news of her sacking after she discovered it on Twitter, shared by a pro-Israel newspaper who may have been leaked the story prior to the NUS updating Mrs. Dalali. In response, Dalali has vowed to fight the outcome via a pending legal challenge alleging discriminatory treatment. Mrs. Dalali's sacking has sparked furious anger across the British Muslim community, who believe this is gross censorship of pro-Palestine activism.
Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is like comparing apples and oranges. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish faith. Actually, it's the weaponization of the Jewish faith that we are seeing. What we are talking is a colonization enterprise. That is the whole existence of the Israeli regime is a colonization enterprise. It's clear that the whole issue is to criminalize pro-Palestinian sentiment, which actually shows you how effective pro-Palestinian sentiment is.
Things could get very ugly for the NUS as Muslim student bodies are threatening a boycott and Dilali plans her fight back. The NUS has previously prided itself on being an inclusive environment for all and an advocate of free speech. However, they now have to prove that that is indeed the case amid racism and Islamophobia accusations thrown their way by the former president, Robert Carter, London.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of a slain journalist should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, Employers Association Confindustria and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency ISTAT has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Latte, pane, milk, bread, pasta. All these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni traveled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international condemnations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Sister Rehana Kazemi. She has done Bachelor's of Science in Applied Psychology. She's a researcher in the Hafsa Ilmi of Qom, and her research right now is on best trainers and coaches for students in non-Islamic countries with Islamic perspective. A very warm welcome, sister, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much.
All right, sister, I would want to continue with the what we missed in the previous session. We were talking about bullying, the children who are the victims of bullying, the children who themselves start bullying others. And we came to the conclusion that if you have Islamic values at your home, at least if you're practicing them at home, and if you talk to the teachers, you won't be giving out a child who's bullying others. And if your child is a victim, teach him patience, teach him brotherhood, and teach him to ignore those who are irritating him.
Yes.
And try to tell him, forgive others. And that was the beautiful thing that Islam teaches us. Now we reached a point in the last discussion. We said that the first 7 years, when we actually produce a bullying child into the society, is a result of the first 7 years where you considered your child a king and then you neglected some of the things. I would want you to shed some light on those things.
Yes. We talked about not only first 7 years. I said there are three sets of age, 1 to 7, 7 to 14, and 14 to 21. So if we mention the children's mistake from the early age, this should be very helpful. Do not ignore their mistakes. Try to realize.